Dark wings.
Dork words.
A Game of Thrones podcast.
Episode 16.
Science fiction.
Act 2.
Welcome back, everyone, to Dark Wings, Dork Words. I am your host, Chuck Davis, and with me this week,
Brendan J.D. Riley,
Molly Welsh,
and Eric Solonis.
So, back into science fiction.
Here we go.
We have established what the science fiction genre may be defined by.
At least to us four geeks at this table.
And we touched upon, we dangerously wandered into Star Wars territory and... and got out fairly quickly. And I was all ready to wander into Star Trek territory right on the back of that after we decided we wouldn't talk about those things. But we did manage to stay out of Matrix territory almost completely. However, we're going to outsource the Matrix discussion to Molly's friend. Did we do that in the last episode?
Yes.
That already happened?
Yes.
Perfect.
He skipped over that part because he really didn't want to dive into Matrix territory.
Okay. Yeah.
That's okay.
So, the subheading of this episode could be the dudes of sci-fi, because we're going to talk about dudes, some literature dudes, and some filmmaker dudes.
Oh, yeah.
We sort of, some of us picked three examples of our favorite films that we'll touch upon, and Molly kind of picked three categories of discussion related to sci-fi. We'll talk about some bad examples of sci-fi as well.
Mixed Mistress Molly. I don't like that.
You don't like this?
What about Mastress? Like it's some master, but like with a female.
Mixed Maestro.
No.
Boombox Productions presents you with a mixtape somewhere in here that's appropriate, so you'll have to listen for it. But it'll be our top three mixtape, so it'll come out of that top three discussion that we have.
Molly has the most righteous soundtrack collection in the history of podcasting, and she will grace us with some examples of greatness. Let's get into a little bit of some of our favorite examples of science fiction.
Literature,
right. So...
probably the best dude to start off that discussion would be Mr. Philip K. Dick. Would you agree, Chuck?
Philip K. Dick is certainly an icon of science fiction literature. Absolutely a genius. Written many, many, many great stories, many of which have been inspiration for science fiction films, but has very rarely been directly adapted to any great effect. Like, Blade Runner is one of my top three science fiction films. But the movie Blade Runner, the story, is only loosely based on a Philip K. Dick story called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? A book that I've owned since I was 12 and I still haven't read. But I did get into a Philip K. Dick... I went off on a Philip K. Dick kick, if you will, about 5 years ago. And I read like three other of his stories. And I have seen plenty of other movies that were loosely adapted from his.
In my instant queue on Netflix, there is an hour and 17-minute documentary of Philip K. Dick and his legacy literature and how it's been adapted, and I'm really looking forward to watching that. Well, The Adjustment Bureau is one of the newest.
Yeah, it's and I mean, some of the hallmarks of Philip K. Dick, sort of dystopian future. He was a very paranoid individual. So paranoia is a recurring theme in all of his stories.
I think I remember reading something, and I don't know, I might be very wrong here, but that there was some sort of something where he was diagnosed with a mild form of schizophrenia, like the paranoid version of schizophrenia.
No, I think that's true. I think he was heavily medicated. Drugs play a prominent theme in a lot of his stories. Mm-hmm.
A twin. That's interesting to me.
Oh, he was a twin.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating.
I don't know. I've always... If you're not a twin, twins are fascinating.
true. If you are a twin, boring.
Delete. Can we get some sort of weird eerie music every time someone says the word twin?
Yes, you can.
Well, that's another excellent sci-fi theme. And soap opera theme, coincidentally, is the evil twin.
I'm looking at this website, and philipkdick.com, and it just has like a short list of the films. So Blade Runner, A Scanner Darkly, Total Recall, Minority Report, Next, Paycheck, The Adjustment Bureau, and others, like other adaptations. But those are probably what he's known. Those are what he's known for.
I think A Scanner Darkly is the most faithful adaptation of one of his books. They did an excellent job of taking multiple characters and making composite characters out of them, hitting all the right plot points story-wise while simplifying the narrative, and the way that they animated it, which I forget what they call it exactly, but it's where they digital artists hand-painted every frame of film to give it this very ethereal,
visually
otherworldly visual. It's so neat to look
at. And a very well done film, just as far as directing and acting goes, I think, as well.
Absolutely. I mean, Keanu Reeves, it was a perfect role for him, where he's sort of playing the cipher of an everyman who has little to no personality, and Keanu Reeves is your man. but I mean, that it's a strength. It's a strength when used in the right films, and this is one of them.
Total Recall is one that I've watched over and over. I'll be honest.
Total Recall is a very fun, kitschy movie. It's so good. For sure.
Yeah.
But it's all
get your ass to Mars.
No, it's the Quay. I mean, I quote, like, people quote that all the time. Somebody will start the reactor.
South
like,
Park even made a reference to
right? It's just one of those
there's
movies.
There's a whole Quado episode of South Park.
I love it. I've never seen
I think
a Scanner
we
Darkly.
Even talked about that when we were referencing. I know that there was an earlier podcast where somebody was talking about Quaid, but
The most Philip K. Dick moments of Total Recall are those early scenes where he goes in and he has what like his the vacation implanted in his brain kind of a thing, but he ends up he finds out that he's really an entirely different person than he thought he was. And so that's where the paranoia aspect kicks in. But of course, Arnold never really spends a lot of time worrying.
Right.
He's just perfectly happy to become a super spy or whatever he
and
is.
Throwing
that
in,
is indeed what happens.
And throwing in Terminator quotes on payphones.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's fuck you, asshole, a Terminator quote. It is when Arnold Schwarzenegger's in the movie.
It is. but it was only one selection on the list.
Mm.
So only the Arnold model of the T-808, I think he was.
What?
Sorry.
No, T-81. Texas Instruments.
The TRS-80.
Filtration model unit 101.
Say it louder.
No.
So Blade Runner, though, even though it's not a great adaptation of the original source material, is an iconic, brilliant, great science fiction film. And it's one that it has some of the elements that I love about science fiction, in that it's very serious, it's very dark, it presents a dystopian future that seems fully believable and yet fully alien and bizarre. It plays around with some of the ideas of artificial intelligence and the morality of using machines when they rise to the point of becoming sentient.
Well, and very, very Matrix. I mean, the Animatrix is one of my favorite things about The Matrix.
Yes.
And that whole episode where it's like, but I'm real! And the robot shouts right before they, like, beat it to metal shards. And, I mean, one of the most jarring things about Blade Runner is how much it hurts to watch what they're doing and how we're treating and whatever. The distance between...
Between replicant and human.
Exactly. The morality of the replicant. And, you know, whether it's moral to limit the life of a machine that can experience everything that has the full range of human emotion. And
that has been huge in so many... I mean, the way they treated Six in those episodes of Battlestar when people were just, like, beating and raping her for fun.
Yeah.
And AI with the whole... little boy. Like, I mean, that's been such a huge thing for us as human beings to relate to in science fiction.
I remember being, I think it was maybe, you know, 10 or 11, and getting a Boys Life magazine from Boy Scouts that talked about, you know, the world of the future and how computers are going to have their own, basically, minds. And there was this, there was an article talking about, like, will we come to a point where we will feel bad about turning off our computers because our computers say to us, hey, every time you turn me off, I die. You know, or something like that. Or like, I don't want to be turned off.
Well, and how? Like, I mean, all of those computers. Yeah.
Will I dream?
Right.
Even, like, as horrible as the movie was, iRobot, you know, really kind of went into that too. Like, of, you know, the separation between morality and will, and if we can program will into a machine.
Well, that adaptation of an Asimov story, very, very loose adaptation. I haven't read you know, the Foundation trilogy or whatever it is.
Yeah.
But Isaac Asimov has a set of stories where he established, like, the three laws of
robotics.
Three laws
of robotics, yep.
And so they touch upon those in the Will Smith adventure where he runs out shooting robots.
The Ender's Game series, Orson Scott Card, is one that I started reading that was, to me, some brilliant sci-fi. And the way that he has set it up, where you read Ender's Game, and that's, like, your foundation. And then you can pick any book that goes with it and go on your own journey of the series itself. So I read Ender's Game, and then I read Ender's Shadow, where Bean, it's basically the
it's
same
a retelling
book,
of the same story, but from a different character's point of view.
And the beginning and end points of the journey are different. Like, you start with Bean's birth, and those are just beautiful work done where, like, because the main, you know, work we start in the blah, 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 and then there's this new world order at the end with sci-fi. But they're just so damn relatable.
Ender's Game is a brilliant standalone story.
Yes.
And then he went on and he did, is it Speaker for the Dead? Is that the next one? Or there, he made it, it's a trilogy, or there's four, but the series, the, each one is sort of like light years beyond the premise and concept of the one that came before.
Yeah.
And the, but
they've made them into graphic novels now, which is very cool.
And they're finally going to make an Ender's Game film, apparently starring the kid that is in Scorsese's Hugo, that's just out in theaters right now.
Okay. Yeah.
Who apparently is a very bright young person to play that kind of role. Although they're like they do always do in the movies, they age the characters because it's impossible to get performances out of very, very, very young characters.
And keeping with the dudes, we don't have to dwell too much on Mr. Adams, but Hitchhiker's Guide and all that goes with is worth mentioning as some, like, exceptionally fun British sci-fi tongue-in-cheek. And, you know, the BBC went nuts with Hitchhiker's Guide, and then the American version, Sam Rockwell and Mos Def. But just the fact that, you know, we annihilate every ounce of what we think it's going to be about in the first, like, 10 pages.
Oh, it's just awesome that the Earth gets destroyed while the main character is still sort of hung over and just waking up in the morning.
Yeah.
And then sick. And then he just sort of is thrust into this world where everything he knew about the universe is wrong.
And it hits
and
him so
it's
fast.
So ridiculous. One thing I didn't appreciate, as I loved Hitchhiker's Guide as a kid, again, there's an excellent BBC radio production of it that's almost more fun to listen to, and a lot of the story details are different, but a lot of the voice actors are the same. And then there's a great TV version, again, with a lot of the same characters, or same actors, with wonderfully low-budget Doctor Who quality special effects. But I didn't realize that Douglas Adams got his start writing for radio first, and then writing for Doctor Who.
Oh, wow.
And so, in a way, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is really almost a parody of Doctor Who.
It is.
I mean, it could take place in the same universe, in a sense.
I read all of the books all at once, because I have the, you know, the collection, so I didn't really, in my head, it's all one story.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole, I don't remember the title of the actual book, The Cafe at the End of the World, the Diner,
the Restaurant,
the
Restaurant at the End of the Universe.
And thank you. Like, that to me was just so, yes, the radio, his radio-ness became more prominent the farther you went, and it was just so easy to hear everything. It had its own rhythm. It's very good. I really, really like it. But the American version I was kind of disappointed with, just because the filmmakers who have something to say like that, who only get that one shot, end up trying to say too much, and then it doesn't.
The recent film version, you mean?
Yeah, it was just too goofy.
It wasn't actually an American version.
Was it?
They were British filmmakers.
Oh.
And they were operating off a script that Douglas Adams himself had been working on up until he died. But in spite of that, it was a sort of an unnecessary adaptation. It just didn't live up to... I mean, honestly, I'd rather go back and watch the 1983 cheesy graphics, bad made-for-TV version, because that fits the flavor, the spirit of the story better than having state-of-the-art special effects.
Yeah. And Dean Koontz, whom sometimes people wouldn't classify him as a sci-fi writer, but he's sort of in that same Stephen King, where Stephen King's known for horror, but a lot of the really great stuff he writes is fantasy, or has something to do with fantasy elements. But Dean Koontz wrote a book called Watchers. Mm-hmm. It's very science fiction, and the movie was absolutely awful. And there's another book called Lightning that has to do with time travel that's very good. And then he wrote this other story that I can't remember the title to, that was all about a woman in a house with the AI intelligent security, and it like takes over her life and tries to own her and control her. And so there's a lot of really good things that the dude, Mr. Dean Koontz, has contributed. But like Stephen King, most of the movie adaptations have been utter and complete shit.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's just it. There's the original story, and then any adaptation could run the gamut of quality.
Right.
I think we're pretty lucky that Game of Thrones has the quality that it does, even though it's not approaching mega epic, Peter Jackson.
Right.
Like, big screen.
As yet.
But
as yet, hopefully.
Ooh, as yet. That's a challenge, HBO.
As far as we're talking about, writers, there's two writers, and I haven't read a whole lot of Ray Bradbury, but Ray Bradbury is definitely a science fiction writer, and I would say even more so in The Illustrated Man than in, his Martian Chronicles stuff. But as far as my favorite author of science fiction, and probably in general, is Kurt Vonnegut, and he's not really seen as a science fiction writer, but... As far as what Eric was talking about in the last podcast of taking the focus, and focusing in on something of our society, that's what Kurt Vonnegut seems to do. He really did respond to a lot of things that were going on in this time. And there's three specific stories that I'm just going to put out there to listeners that you should check out if you haven't already. Harrison Bergeron, Slaughterhouse-Five, and I can't remember the name of it, but it's. It basically it was written in 1950-something, and it describes kind of what we go through today with having all these devices that anyone can get a hold of us on any time, and we're constantly being advertised to, and...
Like while I look up the title of this thing on my smartphone?
Exactly. And, back then in the 50s, he didn't have cell phones, but it was like tiny radios that you wore on your wrist, and it was illegal to deface these in any way, and this man ends up smashing a bunch of these. And anyways, I can't remember the name of that title, but Kurt Vonnegut, I think, is a great science fiction writer for those reasons that Eric was talking about in the last podcast, of being able to look at society and focus in on it and say, these are the things that I'm noticing that kind of seem out of place, and putting it in a very entertaining, interesting, thought-provoking science fiction vein.
Yeah, Kurt Vonnegut, another one that's very difficult to adapt.
Yes.
He has such a unique voice.
Most definitely. Especially here, there was a Harrison Bergeron movie that came out in the early 90s, late 80s, I think, with Sam Gamgee from Lord of the Rings.
Sean Astin.
Which really kind of sucked. It was okay. But there's another adaptation of Harrison Bergeron called 2083 that is a short, maybe it's called 2083. It was a short story, but there's one called 20-something. It's on IMDb. I saw, and it's actually a Game of Thrones reference because the guy that plays Harrison Bergeron's dad plays Lord Commander Mormont of the Night's Watch. But that one looks great as an adaptation of Harrison Bergeron.
Speaking of adaptations, the other dudes that we need to talk about is Frank Herbert.
Oh, Frank Herbert, yes.
Frank Herbert, yes.
Dune, the fact that, you know, we had the Dune, the spies movie, and then we also had, like, sci-fi made it into a miniseries, and then they went with Children of Dune, and... Mm-hmm.
He who controls the spies.
Everybody has had their own experience with the Dune-ness. And, I mean, I read the book, and I watched the first movie. I saw the miniseries. I didn't ever watch the Children of Dune miniseries, but the 80s movie has always, like, completely... I'm in love with it. I'm mystified.
I love it, too. I sort of unabashedly love it. And my love for it has only grown over the years. I remember being a little perplexed and fascinated by it.
Right.
When I first saw it, walking out with some friends who were kind of, like, ragging on it. And then the backlash was just immense. Everybody just said it was a complete failure and so funny and ridiculous and just not cool. And I thought it was super cool.
Yeah.
I thought just the art design of it was so otherworldly. You know, just the idea of having wood paneling on the inside of a spaceship is pretty brilliant.
well, even the secret meeting at the beginning, and the Harkonnen, just the way that the evil was portrayed as evil with the dueling and like the nasty.
Well, David Lynch out the is
heart plug on that one servant dude.
It was a match made in heaven. I mean, you've got this incredible, other world that Frank Herbert created that's just so rich, and really the film barely touches upon the depths of interesting ideas that are in the books, but. And then David Lynch brings his whole own sort of visual and filmic sense and creates all these iconic moments and characters that don't even necessarily happen in the books. I mean, there's a couple of missteps, like the Queen music in the soundtrack and just a couple other maybe strange choices. Maybe that's where
Freddie Mercury really came from.
From Arrakis?
Yeah. Wasn't Desert Planet? Cavill? Our favorite Cylon, he was in it, wasn't he? I think he was.
Yeah,
in.
He was. So
Cavill,
was
our favorite Cylon.
Yeah, he was.
He's not my favorite Cylon.
He was some
Cavill
sort of magister
like,
or something
badass.
Like that.
Dean Stockwell. Dean Stockwell was.
So
a
was
very
Patrick Stewart.
Yep.
Patrick Stewart was in it.
That's right. He played.
And my favorite, one of my favorite Italian actresses,
yes.
Sylvia Maggiano, who was the
and Sting,
their queen mother. Okay, Chuck. I don't know if you know about this, but I'm looking at IMDb right now. There's a Dune scheduled to come out in 2014.
Wow.
It's in development.
Far out.
Far out.
Is anybody cast yet?
Nothing.
There's no way it can live up to the first one.
I don't know, man, because that miniseries, it was three episodes, and I did the whole, like, videotaped it, cut the commercials out thing, you know, with the VCR. And it was good. And it was so much more in-depth. You found out more of what
well,
was going
it had,
on.
Well, it had more of the story, but it didn't have any of the flair for just the epic awesomeness on the screen.
I agree. It was more informative for me than than exciting, like the first one was.
Well, it's kind of like, I don't know, kind of like Game of Thrones, where, you know, all the talking scenes, like the intimate dialogue, was there. But, you know, the battlefield scenes and just the epic... look, you know, the camera rotating around the incredible castles and all that kind of stuff was missing.
I felt like the book and that movie, the 1984 movie, were on the same level. I was kind of confused at one point because there was, at one point it got this very specific point of view of, like, the concubine, you know, his mother and his lady and how they, like, they are
the
Bene
Gesserit sisterhoods.
Even Bene Gesserit, it's the fact that, like, the concubine is the woman that inspires the man. Because the very, very end of the book is, like, her being like, right. We are the concubines. And I'm like, wait, what? When did this become about, like, feminism? And
because it's kind of
it was just interesting. I'm not saying it was bad. It
yeah,
was,
no,
like,
I mean, it's
weird.
One of those things that they didn't fully flesh out the idea that's in the book.
But that's how they chose to end it, with this very strong statement about being a concubine and how awesome that
it
is.
It kind of made more sense to me when I saw the one that was on Sci-Fi in 1990 whatever it was, or 2000 whatever it was, at the very end when you see that, you know, he marries and then but he's still with the concubine, so it's like the marriages, much like any marriage in Game of Thrones is all about political alliances and stuff like
the
that.
The joining of the houses, which was kind of a thing they were doing.
But he's still got the concubine, who he actually loves and who actually loves him and who can inspire him maybe to come up with the great ideas.
It is a little weird that in 1984, Virginia Madsen, who played the princess, was like the semi-narrator of that movie.
Yeah.
Which was kind of an odd, arbitrary choice.
Yeah.
But she was a character that sort of witnessed the major events without dying.
only the victors, only the people who survive can tell the history, right?
But, unfortunately, the mass culture didn't fully absorb David Lynch's vision didn't appreciate it as much as I did, so...
Who was Moe Digging That? That was Kyle MacLachlan. Yeah.
Who sort of became David Lynch's muse.
That whole, needle really close to his eye part. Ooh. Oh, dude, that part was so cool.
Which then was reflected in Star Trek Generations. Which one was it where they show Picard becoming a Borg? Anyways, the needle in the eye thing was... just reminded me of it.
But I don't even have a problem with the whole whispered words as internal monologue for dialogue. So where you see person... You know, Kyle MacLachlan's like, I must bend like a reed in the
No,
bend.
I love
the
that
worm
shit. That
is
was so
the
fun.
Spice.
Yeah.
It just has this great creepy flavor. That's very, very cool. The weirdness of the movie certainly inspired me. I didn't immediately rush out and read the books. I did eventually read all six of the original Frank Herbert Dune books. And there's just a wealth of really wild ideas and cool storytelling there. I am not going to bother to read Frank Herbert's son's sort of additional
that came out recently, didn't it?
Prequel kind of things. Just in the past 10 years or so, he's released a slew of books.
Yeah,
that go back and tell stuff from prehistory that's touched upon in the Frank Herbert books.
So, Chuck, two of your top three we've talked about: Blade Runner and Dune. What's your third?
Well, I had a hard time picking, but I and this one almost could have been a horror, but I decided since it turned into a franchise that's not necessarily horror, and since it's one of those iconic sort of movies as a youth that I can't get out of my head, Terminator was my third favorite. And Terminator in itself is true. It's really a horror movie.
I think it's a romance movie.
But it's also a romance. And
I think it's the greatest love story of all time.
It's a good one.
Of all time.
Okay.
It's also a big paradox, but whatever.
Time travel is always touchy.
Yeah.
But it's one of the touchstones, cornerstones at the heart of science fiction.
Yes, definitely.
Time travel is just such a great what if launching point to a great idea for a story. But Terminator really is all about survival on the run and a budding romance and about taking a leap of faith and about blowing up a killer robot.
Though, it didn't turn into a sci-fi thing until T2. Because it could have
There's
stood
only
alone.
Just the hints of what just really... The immensity of what the future holds is all in Michael Biehn's performance. Bane. Is it Bane?
Bane.
Is it Bane?
Like,
it sounds
Bane,
better.
But
or...
Bane, but Michael Biehn.
Michael Biehn.
Because I'm in love with him. Okay. And I've been in love with him since I was 8 years
and
old.
You can't be in love with a guy named Michael Biehn.
No.
Michael Biehn. He has the one nightmare where you get to see the robots crawling around the wreckage of Los Angeles in the future, and just the one Terminator, the rubber skinned Terminator, invading their sort of dugout underground survival shack where they're living, and just that, and just seeing, Arnold Schwarzenegger being this killer robot on the ruthless thing. It's really neat to imagine that. I mean, that's the darkest possible future. If you thought Blade Runner was kind of a bummer, what's going to happen? At least there was, come to the off-world colonies, an exciting world of a chance to begin again in a golden land of opportunity and adventure. Terminator doesn't have that. It's just everybody dies. But it was a compelling enough nugget of science fiction. Really, I mean, maybe just the backdrop of science fiction, or not even the backdrop of that. It's just sort of an allusion to a science fiction world that fully takes place in the real world.
Yeah. And the fact that they were able to make Terminator 2 and then Rise Against the Machine, which didn't exist and we're never going to talk about it ever again, and then Salvation, which was awful, and then the Terminator, the Sarah Connor Chronicles, the TV show, which I actually really, really liked.
They made it work in a way that I didn't think they could.
No, and Shirley Manson was like the most surprising, refreshing addition to that whole thing. Bear McCreary, who did the soundtrack for Battlestar, also did the soundtrack for that. He's doing the soundtrack for Walking Dead now. Nice.
But the most Shirley Manson's character was the most fascinating thing about the Sarah Connor Chronicles, because it's the first time in the whole Terminator universe where they introduced the concept that a Skynet AI entity was not hell-bent on destroying humanity.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, and it brings the whole robot ceiling thing back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And
the
whole Cromartie thing, the guy, he's been in a lot of movies as, like, the bumbling idiot and then, like, the horrible rapist. Now he plays he was The Last House on the Left? The movie's hard to watch.
Haven't seen it.
Oh, my God.
Need to.
But the guy who played Cromartie in Sarah Connor Chronicles also did that whole, like, I'm learning what all of this means, and he was so detached and his views were so skewed. But then the very last episode of, it's still on my DVR, by the way, very last episode of Sarah Connor Chronicles, I totally cried. Like, there's this very open-ended thing in Terminator of when John Connor shows up in the future. You don't know much about John Connor in the future because nobody's ever focused on it, right? So in the last episode of the TV show, he travels through time in the age that he is now.
Is that a spoiler? Is that a spoiler?
I don't fucking care. It's over. It's okay. Like two seasons or whatever. It was whatever. But it was great.
It was a great left turn. Like, the last thing you expect is for teenage John Connor to get launched into the future, exist in a world
where he misses the apocalypse. Like, he doesn't even survive it. He just travels through time when it's already happened and is like, dudes, I know you guys. You're going to know me. Like, I never thought that that's how it...
So do they consider, like, is that canon? Is the TV show part of the story?
Well,
for me, it is. I mean,
okay. It could have been.
Made a choice.
It would have been.
They made a huge choice.
Gotcha. They tried pretty hard to have it fit.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to retrofit it. And if you go back to here, you can rewrite the story from that point forward. And that's what they did.
Yeah. Well, because that was a question that I remember hearing about Salvation, was they were like, What year is Salvation even happening in? Because Christian Bale is this old and, like, you know.
I didn't hate it. I thought I would hate it, and I kind of accepted it.
I kind of like Sam Worthington. And
it wasn't romantic at all.
No, it wasn't.
Speaking of time travel, Eric, why don't you tell us your top three?
Well, one of them is 12 Monkeys, which I think has one of the most interesting time loops in any film I've ever seen, specifically because in the movie, the main female character, I can't remember her name, it's been forever since I've seen the movie.
Madeline Stowe.
Yes, that is true.
I don't know her name, but that's the actress.
You know, because she time traveled from Last of the Mohicans or whatever.
She totally did. And now she's on revenge.
She keeps saying to Bruce Willis's character when she meets him, when he goes back in time, she keeps saying, I feel like I know you from somewhere. I feel like I know you from somewhere. And the thing is, late, of course, at the climax of the movie, you know, they go to the airport, or the whatever port you want to call it.
I don't even mind how many times they play that scene over and over and over.
Mm-hmm. And they go there, and, you know, she...
Terry Gilliam's awesome.
She, you know, he's gunned down or whatever, and he dies in her arms, and she looks into the eyes of the young version of himself. He sees himself die, and he looks into her eyes. So the interesting thing to me behind that is that the young version of himself, he has met her before. So when he sees her, he has seen her before. But she hasn't seen him before. But yet, because there's this time loop where he has met her before, it's this weird sort of almost metaphysical thing that transcends the time loop in a weird way. And so I've always found that very intriguing in that movie.
He's the one that says, you remind me of someone.
She keeps saying, I feel like I know you from somewhere. I feel like I know you from somewhere.
So maybe I always interpreted that as that she has the picture in her book of him when he gets zapped into the trench in World War I.
And then she has a
vision where
she sees him on the wall in that picture. It's in her office.
She goes back. Yeah, after she realizes he's been shot with a World War One era bullet, and she finally begins to believe his psychosis, or she's on the cusp of believing it. She goes and she finds a picture of him in a book that she had read before.
I thought it had been on her wall for a long time because she used the image in lectures that she gave, or something like that.
Possibly. There was But I like your interpretation is far more romantic.
Yeah, it is, and I like that too.
But I agree with you. It's the time loop aspect of it. It's, to me, it's the most perfect time travel story because there's no event that happens before or after time travel. Mm-hmm. It all just happens in the same timeline.
Yeah.
So Bruce Willis's character, all those events happened to him as a young boy.
Yeah.
In the airport. Those happen to him in his past, and he gets to relive them as an adult when he gets to that point. But he didn't grow up without those things happening, and then the time travel event goes back and makes it happen. It all just happens seamlessly, and that to me,
it's also sort of an interesting take on the whole reliving your life thing as you die.
Yes, exactly.
it's an interesting take on the whole. You can use time travel to fix the errors of the past.
Yeah,
for all the time traveling they do in that movie, there's no preventing the disaster that occurs.
Mm-hmm. Right. One of the things that for that movie that I really love about it is the aspect that they think that this 12 Monkeys organization was the one that caused the cataclysmic event, and that in actually, spoiler, but they were an environmental society that freed the animals from the zoo, and how it's like, for me, that is actually a really nice tenet of science fiction, because it's like, we can't know the past, really. We can interpret it in a certain way, but we really have no idea what happened.
Very Terminator Skynet of them.
There you go.
What's the next one on your list?
I have Sunshine, which I really enjoyed. I thought it was a great example of...
Depressing.
Sad.
Not the end, I don't think.
The end was
the most depressing part.
No, because they restarted the sun.
I don't view death as inherently depressing. Mm-mm, if death continues some sort of hope.
The death of Cillian Murphy is depressing.
Cillian Murphy? I'm pretty sure it's
Cillian. It was just death. It was sacrifice.
Sacrifice is
noble.
I remember they're making these genuine connections, and then it's just over, and that's just unfortunate.
And I think that was the point of the movie. Points of the movie is, and it,
well, the, for
everything
me,
ends in death. So what's the point?
For me, one of the best moments in the movie. Sunshine takes. It takes science fiction and uses it to just reflect its, human and morality and everything. One of my favorite moments in the movie is when the three of them, Cillian Murphy and Evans? Is that it? Chris Evans?
Captain America?
Yes.
Yeah.
And what's her name? I can't think of the actress's name.
Memoirs of a Geisha?
She would... She is in that too, but then so is the one who she was in Insidious.
The mom?
You know who I'm talking
Rose
about.
Rose Byrne?
Rose Byrne,
yes.
Thank you.
Yeah.
They're sitting there voting on whether they're going to kill the guy who's on suicide watch or whatever, whether they're going Chris to kill Evans. Him to preserve, air or whatever, since he screwed up. And they're sitting there voting, and it gets to Rose Byrne's character, and she votes no, and they look at her, and she's all like, I know the argument, I know why, I don't care, you can't have that for me, and I love the morality just in that moment of the movie.
I guess one of the reasons I was talking about in the earlier podcast about how I kind of like it when things are explained for a science fiction, and I think that this is one of the best movies where things are explained, but not in an exposition type way, but in a visual, this is how the world works way. Mm-hmm. And one of the examples of that is the oxygen / food garden that they have that is Kertuk by Michelle Yeoh, is that her name?
Yeoh,
yeah. Yeah. Because that just makes so much sense, as somebody who's interested in science fiction and therefore space travel and what we as a humanity might be experiencing. I remember reading a few articles where they were talking about maybe if we go to other planets and other solar systems, that we'll have to have some sort of food supply because there's no way we can stock up for the amount of time. And that just makes perfect sense. They're traveling to the sun, and they've got a garden. They've got an ecosystem growing in this spaceship to not only provide oxygen, but food. And I love that. I love the fact that it takes that type of turn, because it's, you know, usually organic things are not very science fiction, but the fact that garden is there is amazing.
And my third one on my list is Gattaca, which I have always loved that film. I think it's when we were talking about, taking that whole thing about a specific thing about society, reflecting back, I think it's one of the most quintessential things on my list because, I mean, it starts out with this beautiful quote that appears on the screen. It says, "There is no gene for the human spirit." Mm-hmm. And, I mean, the movie is about all this genetic perfection, and it focuses in on that, and yet it shows, how all of this science and all this genetic perfection can still not accommodate for things like that. And it's just, I mean, the whole, I love the movie. I love the atmosphere of it because it's very believable in my head.
Well, and it came out in a time that was a question in American society about, like, maybe we have the ability to map out our children's genomes and. Mm-hmm.
I think we'll get there.
Yeah.
I think that's
believable. I think it has really good actors. I tear up every time at the climax, like at the end of the movie when, like, you find out that the doctor who's been testing him knew the whole time but he let him through anyway. And not to mention it has a gorgeous soundtrack too. Yeah.
I'm not familiar with the Gattaca soundtrack. Thank you for giving me something to do.
Yeah.
Thank you. In the mixtape.
So.
Awesome. In Sunshine, isn't there an element of space madness happening there?
Yes. Yeah,
oh,
there
my
is.
Gosh. Done by one of the best villains I've seen in movies ever. He's the villain in Sherlock Holmes. He's the villain in Kick-Ass.
Mark Strong?
Is that his name?
Strong is a badass.
Interesting. I don't remember him being the bad guy in that movie, but he's been the bad guy in every movie that's come out since that movie.
Well, what's so interesting there's this element of these people who the first mission or whatever, and the guy that went mad, it's they became so addicted to the sun, which is like the source of life, that they all just decided to let it destroy them. And he basically came to this mad conclusion that, that it's the will of God that all humans are meant to die because the sun is dying. So why, it's just...
That's the bummer of being stuck on a ship with a small group of people.
And Mark Strong.
Somebody's going to get the space madness.
Yes.
Okay, I'm looking at Mark Strong's IMDb, and it's just funny that, like, the latest one, Untitled International Thriller. Bet he'll be the bad guy. Blood. Bet he'll be the bad guy. John Carter, bad guy. Warhammer 40,000 Space Marine video game.
Okay.
Bet he's video the bad game. Guy. Green Lantern.
He was so great in Sherlock Holmes. Molly, you wanted to kind of approach your favorite sci-fi movies from the director's or creator's point of view, right?
I do. And I think it's just because there were so many movies that to choose from that I decided to go the four dudes of sci-fi that I couldn't live without and be very brief as to why. The four dudes of sci-fi that I can't live without are Spielberg, Abrams, Ridley Scott, and James Cameron. I have a huge unhealthy obsession with Terminator, Aliens, and Predator. And I talked in our fantasy podcast, there was a comic book on the table during the entire podcast that was Aliens versus Predator versus Terminator.
Yeah.
And I just, the franchises as they stand are brilliant, and these men have all had something to do with that.
But they've all taken bad turns along the way.
They have, but that doesn't mean that my imagination still isn't, like, fancied by every single one of them. You know?
Right, yeah.
The fact that Predator curses and says, like, shit happens or whatever in Predator 2 is just awful, but the whole mythos of all three of those franchises, like, the mythology of them is something that will forever fascinate me. But, I mean, Spielberg gave us IT, Poltergeist, Back to the Future, Jurassic Park, Indiana Jones, he was part of Super 8, Men in Black, Terra Nova, like, he's really defined science fiction for us in, like, this childlike awe way. Now, J.J. Abrams, he reimagined Star Trek, Fringe, Super 8 is one of like the most amazingly human science fiction movies that I've seen in a long time. He also gave us Cloverfield, which was a romance movie disguised as this like science fiction movie, but it's a science fiction movie disguised as a romance movie, and I got a lot out of that movie. Fringe is one of the most like innovative, reinventing itself types of television series out there. Ridley Scott is my number three favorite dude of sci-fi. The original Alien,
yes,
was scary and suspenseful, and it built this humongous thing up for James Cameron to take the reins of for Aliens. And Aliens is probably the movie that I watched the most when I was a kid. Like, it defined me.
Yeah.
I was Newt. I wanted to be Newt. Hold on, let me go back to Ridley Scott. I need to say that I'm really excited about Prometheus, which we've been teased is like a prequel to the Alien mythos. Not actually the storyline itself or Ripley, but the mythos itself. And I'm really looking forward to that because that's what I enjoy the most about the Alien.
Yeah.
Not Winona Ryder, the robot. I enjoy the mythos. What could be what we haven't been able to see. And Ripley, yes, she's, of course, I'm a woman. The get away from her, you bitch thing was... And Michael
What's
Bain,
that?
Michael Bain.
That meme that's been going around the internet that shows all these different science fiction and fantasy heroines saying all this shit, and at the bottom it just has Ripley going, "That's cute."
Yes, she just Ridley Scott really did redefine the genre, and I watched an interview with him about Prometheus, and he's like, "I'm coming back to it." You know, he's excited to be back in that sci-fi thing again with us. And then James Cameron with movies like The Abyss and Aliens and everything that Cameron has done, it's like, I mean, they named Summer Glau's Terminator Cameron in, as a tribute to Cameron. And just those guys, without those guys, the same way with horror, Richard Matheson put down the ball for Stephen King to pick up. Like, these guys have all been playing hot potato with films over the years, and they feed off each other, they work together, and it's like, it's because of those dudes that I feel the way that I feel about Terminator and Aliens and Predator.
But none of them had anything to do with Predator.
I'm just saying.
None of those dudes.
I'm just saying.
How cool would it have been, I think, though, to have seen the original Alien in theaters, because I mean, there was stuff in that just totally redefined.
I can imagine
science fiction and horror.
Yeah,
I mean, just the first image—you don't know what was going to happen in the movie, you know, and it bursts out of the person's, I mean, chest, and then that first image of the guy, like, you know, looking for the cat or whatever, and that first image of the alien just rising up behind him. You've never seen anything like that before.
Like, it makes my stomach screen. It makes me quiver. Like, I absolutely love it. I have the original Alien Director's Cut poster in the Lady Cave where we have
A Director's Cut of Alien?
I think so.
Yes,
I mean,
there is.
It says it's Alien Director's
What's
Cut.
There's a Director's Cut of Aliens, too.
Yes. Which has the remote machine gun and the
and
turret
it has
in
this
the
interesting stuff about like Ripley's daughter and stuff that like because Ripley's
daughter
like,
it has the scenes
when she was
it has the it, yeah. it opens with the settlers getting attacked for the first time.
Yeah, and
yes.
It's Newt's family.
Was so
you
Dude's
see
family.
His brother,
family.
And then when you see her later, you have no idea it's the same.
That
kid.
Was a that was a good opening.
All of those dudes, Spielberg, Abrams especially. Like, I've never been able to connect with Star Trek, and I think it's because you were saying earlier that like it is this utopian society and they had to like create conflict to have a show and each show is its standalone thing. I've never been able to connect to it. And then with Abrams, he introduces us to these really flawed characters in the new Star Trek, and he does this space-time continuum. I had a debate, like a very loud it was an argument with my friend of mine, Jordan Bell. He kept calling this Star Trek that Abrams was responsible for a prequel, and I was like, no. It is a completely standalone space-time continuum alteration.
It's an alteration. It's not a prequel. Yeah. However, it's almost a prequel.
The fact that they started out with Sabotage, Beastie Boys, the kid in the car, like, my God. You knew exactly who you were looking at. You knew exactly who was who the whole time. But it was them if this other thing would
That's
have
right.
happened. And
if
it was
it
just so cool to me.
But if it wasn't for that time travel paradoxy moment that starts the movie, Jim Kirk's character is the only one that's affected by the initial event.
By the initial, but that affects everything else. And that's what J.J. Abrams, for me, if I had to only talk about one dude, and that would be hard for me. But J.J. Abrams, okay, Eric, you nailed it on the head during the fantasy podcast when you said that the reason that we like all of these things so very much is because of the, like, raw human element that we can relate to. Like,
yeah.
in Super 8, in Cloverfield, in that Star Trek, in Fringe, in Lost even, J.J. Abrams does it the best. He's able to make that human connection, that emotional, desperate need to connect with somebody else while you're in this painful place.
He shares that quality with Spielberg in that he puts himself in the role of the movie watcher. He's like, what's the most thrilling thing I can do at this point in the story? And he makes the story serve those moments. You know, he's just a great storyteller in that sense.
Super 8 was the new E.T. Like, both of them did the same thing for me.
It's almost just a ripoff of E.T.
So far because of the situations that you see within the families of Super 8.
Well, it's certainly beautiful. A painstakingly accurate homage.
It is. The credits, like, don't walk away before the credits. It's amazing. Holy crap, it's funny. No, just the connections and, like, the experience that those kids have, it's very E.T. So that's my dudes. Brendan, let's move on to your three movies.
All right, well, my three movies, and this is, you know, from a list of 20 that came down to 13, so it's by no means, it was just kind of random for tonight. But anyway, The Fifth Element.
Woohoo!
Wonderful movie by Luc Besson, French director, and one of the first things I think I ever saw Bruce Willis in.
Okay.
As well as Gary Oldman. Just wonderful, you know, the adventure aspect of it, and then saving the entire universe and alien species and everything, and the design of it as well.
And Tiny as a president? Sorry, but oh my god. And Mila?
Mila Jovovich.
Perfect.
Wow. I think, you know, that was...
And even Ian Holm was in it.
Ian Holm? Yeah.
Bilbo Baggins!
Mm-hmm. So just wonderful, you know, and... If you can pick up the two disc collector's edition where it has all the different making of documentaries and even an interview with the lady that played the diva who kind of disappeared from the public eye after that.
One of the best soundtracks known to man. Dude.
District 9, one of the more recent ones, and wonderful in the aspect that it takes the science fiction thing of quote unquote alien invaders, since they just invaded our space. But then took a look at how we really do kind of still have... I think it was so poignant that it was filmed in South Africa and that it was a South African film, you know, with the whole history of apartheid that they have. But even so, looking at the fear that we have of the other all over the world, you know, people coming into our country, people coming into our world.
And how it affects our budget.
Exactly. Our budget. And how, obviously, people that might need help, even if they're people from other worlds that don't even look like humans, need help. So anyway, District 9, I'm sure we can all agree, is wonderful.
That movie did something to my insides. Mm. That is also a poster down in the lady cave.
It did something to my insides.
It did! It did something to my insides. Like, I can't watch it again. It was so good. Like, I hated that guy.
Yeah.
And you hate him so much, and then when he's going through what he's going through, like, I was in pain for him.
Well, and I think the documentary style of it.
That's one of the most brilliant things about it, is to make the protagonist pretty unlikable.
Yeah.
And so you're just forced to identify with him.
And because he was Murdoch in the new A-Team. Yep. So good. Holy crap.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh my god, it was good, and I feel weird saying that.
More emotional about a bug since Bug's Life.
Yeah.
It was like Bug's Life and then District 9, so.
They made some of those bugs pretty lovable.
That little kid,
yeah. It's heartbreaking when he's like, where's my daddy?
Oh, man.
And I've got to say, like, the fact that we share our top three with each other so we can get as many... in as
different
we
ones,
possibly
yeah.
can, but District 9 was one of those that was, like, on the cusp of everybody's, well, I don't know about yours, Eric, but it was on my, everybody's list.
There's a lot I like about it. There's a fundamental thing that bugs me about it, just the concept that it's so easy to splice the DNA of an alien. Just put it in the human and give him a couple weeks, he'll turn into one of the bugs.
Then my third one is actually Wall-E. One, because I love Pixar. 2, because WALL-E is the cutest robot ever. And 3, because it really actually does take a look at what is going on, what is things that we're talking about, which is, you know, pollution, which is climate change, which is taking care of our Earth and saying, this is a possible future.
And then people don't even look up to, like, notice him until he's made such a fucking stink.
And also, it's the fact that it's like, human beings will just let everything go to waste and get everything done for them. So it's another
everybody
way.
Lets themselves go completely.
Yeah. But it's also like that we get our machines to do everything for us. I think that's the second part of it. Not that we'll just get so lazy that we'll, you know, lose bone density and all be 300 pounds floating around in chairs, but that we will get, we have a phone that we can just say, look up a movie time for us. And
Siri,
Siri
where
goes,
can I hide my dead body?
Exactly. You know? So it shows this danger of us relying too much on technology in kind of a funny way, but in still a way that's like, oh, okay, that's
oh my
crazy.
God. Brendan,
you know, having
I just
robots
had,
teach our babies when they're 3 years old.
I just had a revelation about robots. WALL-E and Eve have this connection. Mm-hmm. Similar to C-3PO and R2-D2. Is this a new definition of sci-fi, that there has to be some sort of, like,
robot
AI connection? I mean, we were talking about that. Like, what does that mean when robots have connections with humans, with robots, with, mm-hmm. like, feelings at all? Is it their programming? Is it our programming?
And you're right, they do
think?
It the
like,
same way, because they have the connection with those two humans that they meet, that WALL-E meets on the ship, the two that he knocks out of, and they realize, oh, we've got a pool! Voiced by John Ratzenberger and that one red-headed chick who's really funny. I can't remember her name. Anyways,
that's a good point. Just to mention, we each tried to think of an example, a terrible example of sci-fi, and there's ample ones out there, and maybe some deserve more abuse than others. I picked the Sylvester Stallone vehicle Demolition Man. It's just such a horrible idea of the dystopian future.
The most horrifying thing about Demolition Man is the fact that sex happens in this weird world where you put on goggles.
You
they
sit next to each other
and
there's no physical contact,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You hold the buzz thing over there and I'll hold and here's your towel.
the only one little teensy tiny reason that I would agree with you is because Dennis Leary is in that movie. And I think that Dennis Leary is brilliant. The role that he plays in the movie is the sane one, but he's the one eating rat burgers underneath the city, so how sane is
oh,
he really?
Oh, he's like
but...
the leader of the rebellion kind
yeah.
of character?
Yeah.
Okay, I forgot about him completely.
I really like the Dennis Leary. Phantom Menace is my pick, for reasons that I don't even need to explain. What's yours, Eric?
Sphere. I'm not going to say anything. It's Sphere.
Holy crap. Brendan?
Mine's kind of obscure. It was a sci-fi television series that my brother and I used to watch because it was so horrible, called Sentinel, where a man was stranded somehow in the Amazon, and it heightened his senses. It was on Sci-Fi Channel. It was horrible.
I have two honorable mentions. Waterworld, The Happening. Just honorable mentions.
Okay.
The Happening was a horror one, though, right?
I don't know. Because of the whole plant intelligence thing, I think it could
Ooh.
Be classified as sci-fi.
I really want M. Night Shyamalan to make another good movie, and I was tempted to watch that one, even though
Don't
everybody told me it was horrible.
Do it, and I
watch
Splice,
it. Just watch it. And make
Splice
it
is on my list because I wanted to like it, and I liked it almost
I
all the way
seen
through.
Splice.
I liked Splice.
Some of it, but it made the like this is the last awful on my.
It was an intelligent remake of Species, kind of.
Oh, no. Species wins, man. Natasha Henstridge? Really? Bam! Michael Madsen and Marg Helgenberger, and I loved the whole concept of the crazy, sex-crazed alien running around having sex with whoever she can until they catch her. I think it's great.
Why is it that the most prominent Mating. Memory for me in Species is Michael Madsen getting a blowjob later in the film?
Because it's memorable! Anyway, Boombox Productions will present a mixtape of some of the music from the movies we've been talking about for your enjoyment.
And next time, we will conclude our amazing... Wait, are we going to do another one of these?
Our trilogy? We have a whole nother hour to go. You know we could do
okay.
it. But it's midnight.
But let's, yes.
Yeah.
It's midnight. I'm a little drunk.
We're kind of running out of steam tonight, but
more dudes to come.
With a little rest, we'll have plenty more to talk about sci-fi wise, and we'll save that for Act 3. So enjoy the mixtape, and we'll see you next time on Darkwing's Dork Words.
A Game of Thrones podcast.
Darkwing's Dork Words, a Game of Thrones podcast. Conceived by Chuck Davis, produced by Boombox Productions, featuring Chuck Davis, Brendan J.D. Riley, Molly Welsh, and Eric Solis. Please, enjoy the mixtape. In this order, it features music from WALL-E, Terminator 2, The Abyss, Fringe, The Animatrix, Total Recall, 12 Monkeys, Back to the Future, Doom, 2001, A Space Odyssey, Blade Runner, A Scanner Darkly, District 9, The Alien Trilogy, and just to bring it all back home, The Abyss once again. See you next time for episode 17, our wrap-up of the sci-fi trilogy.
Thank you. Pull back. Wait a minute. Go right. Stop. Enhance 5719. Track 45 left. Stop. Enhance 15 to 23. Give me a hard copy right there.
came back in time for her, for Sarah. I can't even talk to you
it's
about
not
how
really
many
a
times
paradox.
I've seen this movie, how many plays I've written that is based on this concept.
The
how many
second
times
one
Michael
could be a
Bay
paradox.
Has like invaded my dreams, okay? Perfect Man, Corporal Hicks from Aliens, Kyle Reese, and then of course it's Spot Conlon from Newsies, but still, two of those are Michael Bane. Anyway, keep going.
I think it's a paradox in the same vein that
well,
the
time travel,
time
travel,
paradox
another.
Always paradox.